Great to have you along on the Ideas Network, turning our attention from beer to weather. And our weather guy, one of our weather guys with us right now, Steve Ackerman, a director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison, and a professor here. It's certainly great to have him back. John Martin will be joining us probably around noon.
That's right. He's probably drinking
finishing
beer.
Up his class. Finishing up class.
That's right.
And so if questions relating to weather and climate, I hope you will join in. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Did your area get some of that wintry weather last week? Probably. What did you see? You're worrying about tornadoes right now? You're turning your attention to that? Or are they just a part of life in the Midwest for us here? What about weather forecasts? Do you try to take weather forecasts into account when you plan activities? Where do you get the most reliable information? Those are some things we can talk about. And, of course, we need your input. So give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. We would love to hear from you. And Steve Ackerman, welcome back.
It's great to be here.
It's pretty lousy weather last week.
It sure was. I mean, it was about a week ago that we had a day where we had rain, snow, and ice pellets all on the same day. And a lot of those ice pellets that made the road really slippery to walk on.
That was the day that we moved, my wife and I.
Oh, well, that was a really smart day. You should have asked John for a forecast.
That was the day we moved from one house to across town to another house. Fortunately, we had some great movers and they did most of the work. I'm telling you, that was not the day to be moving.
That was not a good day. Yeah, we had just actually, I'd just gotten back from Australia. I was doing a conference down there, and of course it's there. You know, they're the opposite season for us, so it's their fall, and it was gorgeous. And all of a sudden we're here, and it's snowing and raining and ice pelleting.
What was causing it? I mean, why were we experiencing that nasty weather?
You know, it's just that time of year where the jet stream is flopping around between being north of us when we get nice, warm weather like we're getting today, and then being south of us where it as it moves past us, it brings these frontal systems that, you know, can bring nasty weather.
And we're almost to May.
Almost to May, yes.
That doesn't necessarily take us safely out of snow, does it?
No, although it gets a lot rarer. I know in April, I think in the last 30 years, we've only had 9 Aprils where it didn't snow. But I'm pretty sure that's not the case for May. Maybe we've had 9 Mays where it snowed. We have gotten it. I mean, a couple of years ago, we had like 10 inches of snow in May. So it's possible.
Are there any months where we haven't had snow?
I'd say July and August probably.
I don't know if June.
I think we've had frost in June, but I don't know if we've ever had snowfall in June.
We're safe in July and August.
We're safe in July and August.
But then
right?
We have to worry about tornadoes.
Tornadoes and hail, right? I guess hail's just a different type of frozen precipitation.
Oh, and I got in the mail just today from someone some photos, and I haven't had a chance to look at them, of a tornado that went through a person's area. They sent me a disc, and I haven't had a chance to look at it yet. But a few still photos that that look pretty cool, and at our break at noon, I'm going to run to my office and get those and bring them in here so we can take a closer look at them.
They were
pretty cool.
So we do have to say that it's always good to get good photos, but you really shouldn't be taking photos of tornadoes. Right?
Here's one from 10 feet away.
It's coming at us.
Well, let's take some calls. If you'd like to join in, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. And Dave in Augusta, that's something maybe relating to tornadoes. Hi, Dave.
Well, good morning. Yes, I do have a tornado story. I've always, seen them on TV, you know, the weather guys and on the Weather Channel and news clips of tornadoes. My wife and I went through a tornado 2 weeks ago yesterday.
Ooh.
In Augusta, and I think it was an F1, but it started just behind my farm, and it went came within 300 yards of my barn.
Wow.
But it didn't touch the barn. It affected the trees between the house and the barn. It knocked down 7 trees. It removed part of the roof off the chicken coop and all that. But my question is, the winds must have been so fierce, but they must have went right around buildings without touching them.
Yeah, you can. The real intense winds associated with a tornado are right in the immediacy of the tornado. But, of course, it's a big storm, and so you're going to get winds not quite at the 100-mile-per-hour speed, but in a radius that's further out. So were the trees broken off, or were they actually ripped out of the ground?
They were ripped up. The trees were actually pulled up out of the ground and were laid down on the side, you know.
Yeah.
They toppled down, but they were twisted. It's like one person, the whole trunk was all twisted and snarled, which must have been a pretty good wind, I guess. But it sounded like a train. We heard the train sound twice. Mm-hmm. We went in the basement. The house was pounded. It was over, start to finish, less than 2 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, they're moving 30 to 60 miles per hour, so they go by pretty quick. But I imagine it's still pretty frightening. I've never seen one, and I never hope to see one.
Well, I tell you what, the neighbor down the road seen it in behind my barn on top of a knoll, and he's seen lots of pieces of metal and other debris that were swirling around in it. And I think it was only on the ground for about a mile and a quarter, and then it lifted up and joined another tornado, you know, a little bit later. But definitely not something you want to go through again.
Yeah, wow. And so your barn didn't get hit, but did it get hit by flying debris at all?
Right. Well, the barn windows at the lower part of the barn got sucked out. I've got to replace all the windows in the barn. But the upper part, we've got an antique shop up there, nothing. Nothing was moved off the shelves or nothing. It was amazing.
There's all these amazing stories about a piece of straw that's been burrowed right into a tree trunk, and or a cow that, you know, is found a half mile away that picked up and carried.
Yeah, there's great stories. And, I mean, there's photos. I've seen photos of, you know, a whole area just destroyed. And then one house just untouched. Yeah. It just missed it. And then there's a story that I've heard, I don't know how true it is, of the Bonneville tornado, where, you know, after it went through, people were in the middle of the street talking, and then this cat just fell. And it was fine. It was alive. It just fell down. It was, like, right there.
I think that certainly could be the case. I don't know why not. I mean, there have been many instances of people that were actually lifted up and carried 30, 40, 50, even 100 feet and set back down. Our caller was from Augusta, I believe, in that area.
Yeah.
I had a friend who was driving in the Augusta area. This is several years back, and the winds are picking up, and the story, you know, this tornado coming. So he kind of pulls off the road because the winds are really, or he's going to pull off the road. So he slows way down. He can't see for the rain and everything else. And suddenly the car just lifts up and goes over and drops back down on the side of the road.
Whoa.
It just lifted up, moved over, and dropped down.
And he was fine.
He was fine. Yeah.
Yeah. Must have been really scared. But
we were on a fishing trip in north of Augusta once with my dad and my brothers and I, and a tornado came through. And it is quite a sight to see a boat come up out of the water, and we were in a cabin, and it dropped the boat motor on top of the cabin next to ours. We watched
the boat come over,
carry it about 30 feet in the air, and drop it down on top of the roof of the next cabin. And our cabin wasn't touched, and that one was smashed pretty good. So there's always good stories.
Yeah, I mean, they're really, really violent, but they're relatively small, too, and I think that's why you get these great stories.
What is the wind? What kind of wind speeds do we get in a tornado?
The stronger ones, you get above 200 miles per hour. And they're rotating really, you know, even if it's a mile wide, which is a pretty big tornado, it's going 230 miles per hour in one direction, and then, you know, half a mile later, it's going in the other direction.
Yeah.
And so that's why when he was talking about how the trees look really twisted, I mean, that's what happened. There's a lot of talk on the things it hits. Yeah, a lot of corkscrewing.
John in Janesville, we go to you next. Hi, John.
Yes, a lot of prevarications out here, but I'll never forget the stories of a car in a tree and a motorcycle on top of an outdoor privy and the knife in the tree, as over in Belmont some 40, 50, 60 years ago, all those stories. But what I really called about is to tell you that there's only one month that it never snowed in Wisconsin, and that's August. And an example of snow, May 11th, 1990, 6 inches of snow in the Madison area. Mm-hmm. And on that same year, October 11th, which would be, I guess, five-some months later, snow again in October. And some say it snowed on 4th of July in perhaps 1928. Of course, I wasn't around then. But August is the only month that we've been snow-free, according to the records.
Okay, that's interesting. I would have guessed that there would have been some time in the early 1900s or even in 1800s where we got June snow. But I guess I could see it in the northern part of the state getting it in July.
I can say it. John, thank you. Thanks for calling. I thought somebody might call if we made a bold statement.
I thought so, too. We've made these bold statements before and been wrong.
Jan in Eau Claire, let's go to you. Hi, Jan. Thanks for calling.
Hello. I want to have a question about the same storm as the farmer from Augusta. That same day, we didn't get hit with it, but there was terrible clouds and all that sort of thing. But the thing that I want to ask about is the roaring winds. And they must have been a solid roar, like a jet airplane, for more than 10 minutes, because I listened. And my neighbor, two neighbors, said, well, it sounded like a jet plane that was just over us at the same velocity. You didn't hear it come and go. It was the same velocity. So I called a guy on the Weather Bureau at one of our TV stations, and he said it was winds aloft. I don't know what that means, and I wondered if you could explain. It was the weirdest thing.
Yeah, winds aloft are winds that are high up in the atmosphere. And sometimes what happens with these strong thunderstorms, which, you know, are the size of the state. So even though the tornadoes are small, the thunderstorms themselves that generate the tornadoes are relatively big. And what they can do is they can take these strong winds that are aloft and bring them down to the surface. So that's probably what he's talking about, is that the jet stream is like going into the back of the storms, and they're traveling, you know, 110 miles per hour. They get wrapped up in the circulation of the storm and get pulled down to the surface.
There we go. Yeah. Thanks a lot, Jan, for calling. Appreciate your call. Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. Our guest, John Martin, professor and chair of atmospheric and oceanic sciences, will be joining us right after a look at the news here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at weather and climate today with our two guests, the weather guys, Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. He's also a professor here, of course, and John Martin, professor and chair of atmospheric and oceanic sciences, both at the UW-Madison. So great to have them back. They always come by the last Monday of the month. And they're here to answer your questions, so give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, email talk@wpr.org, and if you want, post something on the Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And John, thanks for coming by.
Yeah, glad to be back. I missed last month. I was away.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. Yeah, you were for the conference.
Yeah, I just couldn't call in because of circumstance, so it's great to be back.
Well, I tell you what, we have Phyllis in Waupaca who has a question, so why don't we just go right to Phyllis. Okay. Hi, Phyllis.
Well, and I don't know if it's more of a comment than a question, perhaps. There's so much talk about global warming and climate change, but it seems to me that the climate on Earth has changed dramatically over thousands and thousands of years, has really changed back and forth dramatically. But the thing of it is that I think that even though the climate may change naturally, we should still be concerned about emissions based on its effect on asthma in children and people in general.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, Phyllis, but I'd also add that the emissions of carbon dioxide do nothing except make the planet a warmer place. Whether or not there's something going on in the background, as you point out, is a good question. But the rate of increase of global temperature has never been in the last 400,000 years or some long period of time like that that we've been able to establish through proxy records has never been as rapid as it has in the last 50 or so years. And that is cause for concern given the fact that our the CO2 fraction has gone up by a huge amount as well in the last 150 years. So those two things are probably not coincidental.
And, you know, just this morning, NPR had a segment about rising sea levels as a result of global warming and the effects to reverse or at least slow that situation and the loss of wetlands. You know, that has an impact on weather, obviously.
It sure does.
Yeah.
It sure does.
And there was, I'd heard that report, too, and they were doing something with the cypress trees or something. They were trying to, you know, where the sea level rise is rising, they're trying to mitigate that by adding more land in order to kind of offset it or to put plants there that are going to allow the soil to stick more. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting about what we do. There's no doubt that things are warming up. There's no doubt that the sea level's rising. So, yeah, we got to.
It doesn't seem like we've moved too fast on this.
Well,
no.
We haven't. And Phyllis espouses what should be the truly conservative view, which is, well, you know, if you don't know what's in the hornet's nest, don't poke it.
Yeah.
You know, that's the conservative view. And the view where you just go and willy-nilly poke at a hornet's nest in which you don't know what inhabits it, that's dangerous.
That's dangerous. Yeah. Skip and Milton, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for the great show. I always enjoy these two guests whenever I get a chance to tune in. First of all, I want to say that it did snow on July 4th, but that was before my time, but it was during my grandmother's time.
Hmm.
Now, I can't tell you when that was. I think it was in the early 1900s, but it was 4th of July, and she attributed that, they were talking about a big volcano which affected the world climate for a year or so, that was the reason. So I just don't know what year it was, but it did snow. I believe my grandmother. She was a good historian. The other thing, which my grandmother was involved, too, because she was in our house at the time. They just got into the cellar when the tornado hit. It was on 11-11-11.
Oh, yeah.
Which is 11, not 11, tornado 11. Season. It was the deadliest tornado ever hit Rock County. 9 people died. Many livestock died. Of course, that was before the warning sirens.
Yep.
And it put on the ground and stayed on the ground from Hanover, a little town west of Janesville, all the way to north of Milton, which was a long run for a tornado. And it devastated our neighborhood. It took out all the buildings or all the houses in our neighborhood except ours. But it did do damage. It toppled the chimneys, blew out all the windows, rotated the house on its foundation several degrees. My great-grandfather jacked the house up, and with teams of horses and ropes, they turned the house back to its normal position.
Oh, unbelievable. Wow. In a snowstorm, by the way. They got 6 inches of snow or more in Janesville that same day.
Right. The weather turned brutally cold and windy.
Yep.
So, it was a mess. And then years later, when I was reciting the house, I just couldn't get over how many nails there were in each board on 16-inch studs, and there were only 6-inch siding boards, and there were at least 4 and sometimes 5 nails in each stud. And then as I was ripping it off, it finally came to me, the tornado, decompression, probably lifted the siding out, so they went by. You know, part of the putting it back together, use new nails, but left the old ones in there.
Yeah.
Wow, that's neat. Did you save any of the old nails or the new ones? Or did you think about this too far after the fact? It was already at the.
That's a good question.
I
don't remember. I don't know if I did save any of them. Because there were definitely 2 different kinds of nails, too.
That's really interesting.
They weren't the same. So that substantiated my theory.
Yeah. Very cool story. We had a tornado. We had a comment from one person from Judith tornado came through the neighborhood when she was very young, and the change in pressure sealed her bedroom door shut, and her mom couldn't get to her. Oh, that's Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, saying, wow. Her mom couldn't get to her. She panicked, the mother, and Judith slept right through it. The woman who knows how to sleep. Right. here's a question from a youngster, Olivia, who's a fifth grade student from Wausau, Wisconsin, wants to know, what makes a tornado stop or go away?
I'm going to answer the stop one.
Okay.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think anyone
That's
knows.
A really
That's
good
a great
question.
Question, Olivia.
That's a great
you
question.
You've your whole life ahead of you. You should spend it thinking about that question. And what makes them go away is really similarly hard to answer. I think it may be a little bit easier. They tend to be tied to individual thunderstorms, which are carried around by winds in the upper part of the atmosphere. So wherever those winds happen to be blowing, it's most likely your tornado is going to follow that thunderstorm. But why they stop is a great question.
Yeah, because sometimes they stop, but the storm doesn't stop.
Yeah, that's
right. The storm keeps going.
That's right.
Yeah.
They're very rare phenomena. So if you ever see one and you are lucky enough to not be hurt by it, you should consider yourself lucky because they are fragile. Yeah. They don't last long.
Let's go to Paul in Two Rivers, Wisconsin. Hi, Paul.
Hello. I have a quick question. An old friend of mine is trying to convince me that lightning will take frost out of the ground. And I'm thinking, what?
Well, where it hits.
Yeah, it will. It'll fuse the sand into glass.
Yeah.
It gets pretty hot.
But I don't think it'll generally do it widespread. It'll be where it hits if there's frost on the ground. But it's not going to make it go over a big, large area. So you're right, Paul. I'd continue to argue with him.
Yeah, and okay. Up the ante.
I have another quick question, if I may.
Sure.
Why is it important to document whether or not damage has been done by a tornado?
Oh, because that's how we determine the strength of the tornadoes.
Yeah.
So if you see a big tornado, you don't know whether or not it's a F1 or an EF1 or an EF5, which is the strongest tornado, until you actually go and document what damage it was done. So you know, for example, if a concrete building was totally destroyed, then that's the strongest tornado that you can have.
Yeah. And that is what number would that be?
That would be an EF5.
Yeah. The 5 is the biggest.
The 5 is the biggest, right. And the F is for Fujita, named after the person who did it. But then as building codes have increased, the National Weather Service realized that they had to change the scaling in terms of total building destruction, you know, is no longer a 4. It's got to be like a 5. So now we call it the enhanced Fujita scale. Mm.
Is there an EF6? There used to be an F6.
People used to talk about it, but I don't think there has been anything ever categorized.
No,
as an
that's
EF6.
Right. They left it there as a, you know, unimaginably
strong
tornado in case
right.
it ever happens, but maybe they've just decided it's not worth it.
So it's going to come out in a Twister type movie.
Yeah, right.
It's EF7.
There you go, Paul. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. And on to Dan in Waukesha. Hi to you.
I'm doing fine, thank you. Appreciate the call.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I have a quick question for you, and it's actually regarding clouds. It's an issue that I've been pondering for quite a few years, and I'm glad to have the opportunity to present this here. But my question is, you know, I understand evaporation, convection currents, the rising of the moist air to where it gets cold and condenses. But what I don't understand is why we form clouds rather than just a dispersed, diffuse water vapor up there. Why do you end up with these masses that are clouds rather than a diffuse, layer of condensed water up there?
Good question.
Yeah.
And I think the answer is that in order to get water to condense and to form any kind of liquid water, from the gas phase to the liquid water, it needs help. It needs energy help because it takes a lot of energy to get these water molecules together. And that help comes from aerosols or polluted particles. And so since there's a lot of small particles in the atmosphere, it becomes energy more efficient to condense the water onto those particles than it is to try and just make one film, thin film.
Yeah. And also the updrafts that convey the water vapor to higher elevation, as you point out, and then the air gets colder and you get closer to saturation, those updrafts are not widespread either. And so you have sort of hot spots where there's air rising, may be surrounded by a broader region where the air is gently sinking instead. And so you're not going to get any clouds forming where the air is sinking. And so you get this concentration of saturated air right in the core of the updraft. And so that manifests itself as a cloud in one spot as opposed to a thin, wispy layer of liquid water droplets. It's a very good question, though.
Yeah. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. And we have an email from John in Madison. My brother's a conspiracy theorist, and he was showing me videos online of UFOs, which I stated looked a lot like what ball lightning is supposed to look like. He remained convinced they're UFOs. Could you explain what ball lightning is, why it occurs, and why it moves like it does?
I'm not sure that we yet know why it occurs, but ball lightning has been described just like the words would imagine. It's just a ball of light that glows and just seems to randomly move around. And it's been cited by a lot of people. I've seen YouTube videos posted about what ball lightning is, but to me that generally is not what I consider as ball lightning, because a lot of times it's associated with the flashes and clouds. Whereas most of the descriptions that I've heard, it's just something that kind of floats around in a room and then can just float right out of a room again.
Yeah, I've heard that too, and it comes through keyholes or through doorways stuff.
Well, we had somebody call and say it went right through a room they were in.
That's right, we've had a number of, folks call over the last 10 years describing it, which makes me a believer that it's real.
Yeah, me too, but I think there is a skeptical community in our own science that says maybe we don't really understand what we're talking about or we don't yet have a convincing explanation of it or something.
Yeah.
So it's still out there a little bit.
I'm still convinced we don't know what it is that causes
it.
But I know people are doing experiments in labs trying to figure out if you can form a glowing ball.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Bob and Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Oh.
What's on your mind?
There we go. Hi. I posted this on the Facebook page, but I've been real curious about the severity of the storms that have been moving through the midsection of the country, all the destruction, the deaths. I listened to several meteorologists on the Weather Channel who also have commented about the unusual severity of these storms. And then you juxtapose all of that with this drought that is going on in Texas. And they're referring to that as a historic drought. And I'm wondering if that also is a factor or a symptom of the climate change phenomenon.
That's a good question. We can't ever be sure of some weather event that's hot off the presses whether or not it really has its roots tied back to a global change in the climate or not. One of the things that's been interesting the last couple of weeks has been the fact that the weather is, I'm not sure that it's been more severe in any individual example, but it's been more frequent than usual in a two-week period over the Ohio River Valley, southern Mississippi River Valley, places like that. Mm-hmm. The pattern of the atmospheric flow over the continental U.S. has been pretty stationary. It's been a lot of waves have come through across the desert southwest and then into the Ohio River Valley, but they haven't moved northward. We really haven't had, though it's snowed and sleeted here, we haven't really had significant precipitation in any of those events. And so we've always been on the northern periphery of this fairly long-lived period of interesting convective weather south of us, culminating in the St. Louis tornado, which wasn't the worst tornado they've ever had by any stretch, but certainly one of the more recent. Certainly they haven't had one like that in recent years. So I don't know if I could tie it to climate change, but certainly it's been an unusual second half of April. No doubt about that.
There you go. Thank you. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Bob. And Oliver in Lancaster, your turn. Hi, Oliver.
Hello. I'm thinking of a phrase weather-wise that I heard years ago. That was a buttermilk sky. It's an old song.
Yeah, but it's an old song.
Are you going to hum it to us?
Pardon?
Are you going to sing it? I don't think I've ever heard it.
Me either.
Yeah, but is such a phenomenon as a buttermilk sky.
Buttermilk sky.
The only thing I can think of is kind of something we saw maybe a couple of days ago. Yeah, sort of a yellowish sky where you have maybe a thicker layer of cirrus overhead at midday or something. You can get a look that has that tinge to it. Maybe the song suggests it's a harbinger of rain or something within 12 or 24 hours. If so, I would agree that's often the case.
Yeah.
Yeah, if I remember the song right, a guy's going to see his girl, and oh, buttermilk sky, you know, it's the weather seems uncertain.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, his level of uncertainty is certainly not probably tied to the weather in that case, is my guess.
Okay. Well,
but I think you're right. I think that does portend some unsettled weather in the near future. I would guess that's right.
Yeah.
Old buttermilk sky. I think those three words are the only three words I can remember from that whole song. Thanks, Oliver. We have another email, Pat in Luxembourg, about last week's snowstorm in the Kewaunee area. We experienced snow, thunder, and lightning concurrently, which doesn't seem to be typical. What circumstances either prevent this from happening on a regular basis or contribute to this happening like last week?
Yeah, that's a good question. This is where being in the month of April really comes into play, is that the air that kind of finds its way into the region where clouds and precipitation develop, you know, in the northern part of the state last week, was really air that originated over the Gulf of Mexico a couple of days earlier. And its stratification that it has, its ability to turn into convection, was enhanced in April as opposed to January and February, when air from that low latitude isn't as often involved in weather systems as it is in April. So all you need is to have the air cold at the ground and just a little bit above the ground to have the snow remain as snow as it comes out of the clouds. Yeah. And then they can be thundering and lightning while they're dropping snow, which they often are in the summertime. It's just that they melt by the time you get to the ground, you get raindrops.
And actually, it's been really weird because it seems like since January, we've had about four thunder snow days.
Yeah, yeah. It's been unusual.
It's really uncommon for that.
I agree with that. Yeah, I agree with that.
What are Brett wants to know, what are gravity waves like the one reported to blow the roof off a Beloit daycare center last week when they were when there were no thunderstorms in the area?
Oh, I didn't hear about that story.
I didn't hear about that either.
Gravity waves.
Gravity waves are undulations in the atmosphere. You don't often you can't really, you know, hang your hat on them the way you could on a weather map. Look at a here comes a big winter storm, it covers 10 states. Gravity waves are much smaller in scale than that. And they're set off by a variety of different mechanisms. But what they do is they create exactly what they sound like. If you take the gravity out, when you make them sound complicated, they're waves. And so there's a wave in the atmosphere. And if you have a barometer, you can actually measure the effect of that wave at your location by the pressure going up and down very, very rapidly. Pressure changes on the order of, you know, the same kind you'd get when a big winter storm comes your way that might be dragged out over 24 hours might occur in 5 minutes. In the context of one of these gravity waves. They can be set off by thunderstorms, and the thunderstorm doesn't have to be local to where you feel the wave. So that might have been what happened in Beloit. I don't know the story behind the story there.
And you need a certain type of atmospheric structure to get them to propagate,
too, right?
Yeah,
that's right. You need very specific structures in the atmosphere that tend to be tied to warm frontal regions of mid-latitude storms most of the time, although not exclusively.
Mm. Paul in New Berlin has a question for you guys. Hi, Paul.
Hello. The local television weather guys have been attributing our cool, damp spring with persistent east and northeast winds, which really make it cold in Milwaukee, to La Nina. And I was just wondering what kind of summer weather is typical when there is La Nina.
First, was that a correct characterization, John?
I don't know. I groan at that because I don't really understand how something as local as northeasterly winds off Lake Michigan for Milwaukee County, Waukesha County, and so on can be attributed to a global scale phenomena in the Pacific Ocean. I don't quite buy that. I think that there may be a broad context in which there's something like that, a La Nina going on, but to then go from saying there's a La Nina condition in the northern hemisphere this early spring to that's why it's been cool and damp in Milwaukee County is a little bit of a stretch for me. But I don't know what it means for the summer, the La Nina condition.
Again, and I don't remember, and I didn't look it up because the La Nina condition is really weakening now since December.
Okay.
So it's really damped down. So I don't think it'll be affecting our summertime weather. They're looking at summertime weathers as probabilities of being, you know, equal probabilities of being above normal or below normal.
Yeah.
So they really don't know.
Sticking their necks out.
And Jeff and Ripon?
Yes.
Your question?
Weather patterns on Mars. Where's a good website, you know?
To go for that. Okay.
I wish I knew. Steve probably knows.
Yeah, I would go look for at a NASA site or search on JPL NASA, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. They have probes on the ground and also satellites orbiting Mars now to look at, in particular, dust storm and movements of the air in terms of its effect on the polar. I'm going to call them ice because I think they have some...
I think it's frozen CO2.
It's frozen CO2, and I think there's some water in there, and that's what they're really going after is how much water is in there.
Okay, so JPL...
JPL.NASA.gov.
Okay, JPL.
And search on Mars, weather, and they'll probably come up with something.
Yeah.
There you go, Jeff. Guys, thank you so much. The time flew.
Boy, that was good. Sounds good.
All right. We'll see you then.
Thanks so much. Steve Ackerman and John Martin. Steve directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. He's a professor here as well. John Martin, professor and chair of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison. They'll be back the last Monday of May, and we'll do this again with them. Dustin Maher joins us tomorrow at 11, talk about getting in shape. And at 11:45, Mary Bergen talks about Sidetracked in the Midwest, a green guide for travelers. Stay with us.